All right, this case is Joshua Slinkovich versus Crystal Slinkovich. It's case number 77860, COA, standing for Court of Appeals. This is the time set for the oral argument. Mr. Slinkovich has appealed. He's raised a number of issues, and he's represented by Ms. Fleming. So, Ms. Fleming, if you want to introduce yourself, and we want to confirm that we can hear you clearly, so I'll respond to that. You have 15 minutes. Do you want to save any time for a rebuttal argument?
Yes, I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes, all right. Okay. And, can everybody see her okay?
Yeah, I was trying to find a good lit spot in the conference room because I'm here with my client and we're social distancing in our conference room.
Unfortunately, on my screen, the picture of you contains a picture of me in the top right-hand corner, and my picture is at the top of your head. So I don't know if there's any way to move that picture over to the left instead of the right.
I'm right about in the center.
That's better. In Las Vegas, are you seeing the same thing?
No, we don't have that issue. There's no screen within a screen here.
Oh, all right. So I can see you fine now or better, Ms. Fleming. So go ahead and introduce yourself. And is there anybody else with you there?
Yes, I'm Elizabeth Fleming. I'm a counsel for appellant, pro bono counsel. And my client, the appellant, is here in the courtroom with me, Joshua Slinkovich. An appropriate distance.
Yes, I can see that in the back of that room. All right, where's the microphone?
Oh, my microphone?
Yes.
Yes. If we have a TV here in our conference room and it's sitting on top of the TV.
All right. So just make sure you speak up since the microphone's not directly in front of you.
And just to make sure, Ms. Fleming and Mr. Grigsby, you guys can hear each other okay?
We haven't had any prior trouble hearing. When we did the test run, there was no issues.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here fine.
Okay, good.
Oh, great. All right. So, Ms. Fleming, you have 10 minutes. If you go over, we'll give you the warning.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Please proceed.
I would like to start off with kind of reviewing the standard review we believe is appropriate in this matter. There will be questions of law and application of laws to facts, which we believe should be reviewed de novo, as well as the interpretation of the settlement agreement, which should also be reviewed de novo. The findings of fact should be given, the district court findings of fact should be given deference unless they were not supported by substantial evidence, and then we would argue that it was an abuse of discretion. There's four issues which we have raised on appeal. High level, when a parent moves to modify custody for the purposes of relocation, the modification standards are different dependent upon the physical custodial designation of the parties. In this case, that's significant because of the decree of divorce containing a provision that if the respondent, who lived in Virginia at the time of the entering of the stipulated decree of divorce in 2016, did not relocate to the state of Nevada, that the appellant would have primary physical custody. There was no, just basically she noticed her intent not to return, which we believe she did when she filed her motion to modify custody. It is our argument that de facto then our client had primary custody and that the court should have considered the modification standard based upon my client having primary physical custody instead of joint physical custody. We believe the district court ignored the plain language of the decree and made an arbitrary decision saying that there was a secondary provision that the child would have to be back in Las Vegas by August 2nd, 2018. In the event that the respondent did not relocate. However, that was not a triggering event. It was not did that on or about this date that dad would have primary custody. He had already noticed her intent months before that, and the child was actually already residing in Nevada for most of the summer, and the court made the decision that dad had never exercised primary custody. Therefore, it was not appropriate for the court to consider the moving standard from joint physical custody. From primary physical custody. And that's significant because under joint physical custody, we look at it under Truex, which is a lower standard because you're just considering best interests of the child, whereas under the Ellis standard, where you move to modify from primary custody to primary custody, the court must consider whether there's been a substantial change of circumstances affecting the welfare of the child, plus whether it's in the best interest of the child to move to the new location or to have the custody modified. And in that regard, there is the case law that we've cited, Mizrahi, that the interpretation should be reviewed de novo and that the district court did not make any findings of fact regarding the intentions of the parties when they entered into the decree of divorce, and that that would be an abuse of discretion because of the fact that, to skip into kind of my second factor, is that there is, the parties testified as to their intent. There was a lot of forethought as to why this was in the child's best interest. There was a custody evaluation performed at the time. Appellant did provide testimony as to that, and so did respondent, but the court didn't make any factual findings. And then pursuant to Mosley, when parents enter into an agreement, it's presumed to be in the best interest of the child, especially when there's substantially similar circumstances. And we believe that that was an abuse of discretion for the court to find that it was appropriate to modify under Truex, not preempting the previous argument that we believe the court made an error when by not evaluating under Ellis. So at the time, under Mosley, you know, they had agreed that it was in the child's best interest and that there were similar circumstances, meaning that mom had already resided in Virginia at the time that they entered into the stipulated decree. There had already been consideration of her, the financial situation of the respondent. There was already the consideration that there was an older child present as far as maintaining contact with the sibling. And we do not believe that it was appropriate for the court to use some of these factors to make a modification under the best interest of the child standard. If you're kind of under the Mosley, Nancy Ferraro, and Castle line of cases, that you should not be modifying based upon circumstances, unless we're talking about issues of domestic violence, that were previously present, that shouldn't have been used to modify, to find the best interest in the child analysis to modify. So,
Ms. Lemmy?
Yes.
That brings up an interesting point, because originally this case was in a trial and then it was settled, and the only document is the decree of divorce, and the divorce decree does not mention anything about the domestic violence. And this case is typical of many cases in which there might be domestic violence in a relationship, but it's not put into the actual court documents. And so when a court looks at it later, even though the domestic violence occurred before the time of the last order, it's not reflected in the order. So should the court be able to consider it when it's years later and it's now being advised that domestic violence has an effect on what the custody decision should be?
Well, my understanding of how Nance and Castle kind of encapsulate that issue is that if it was not known to the parties, because, you know, we've overturned the McMonagall in the sense that it's not just a hard line in the sand that you can't go back and review any of the factors. However, with domestic violence, my understanding is if it was not known at the time, or that the severity of it was not known at the time of the entry of the divorce, that it's fair game for the court to revisit that, but that it shouldn't be used to modify custody, but it can be used in a best interest analysis. Like, it can be used as a change in circumstances, but the court can consider it. However, in this case, Judge Moss did hear the testimony from both parties regarding any allegations of domestic violence, and she found that it didn't rise to the level, so I don't believe that the presumption was an issue either previously and or currently and did not affect the court's decision.
Thank you.
And in that regard, under Truex, our argument is that the court should not have modified based upon the Mosley standard, that the parties already agreed that it was in the child's best interest the child to remain in Nevada, to go to school in Nevada, and to live with dad primarily. There was absolutely no change in circumstances that should have affected, and we believe that the district court erred when it did not enforce that agreement, despite the fact that dad may not have actually had physical custody for a period of time deficient. I don't even know what we would need to look back on when we're already looking at the plain language of the decree that says, if this does not happen, then dad has primary. And then mom then moved, but I do not believe that they had already determined what the best interests were and that we did not need to then go back and do another best interest analysis on the merits pursuant to NRS 125C 0035. But there were three things that the district court brought up as far as the best interest analysis, that there was frequent associations with who would allow frequent associations with the other parent. It was a singular incident the day before the trial that the court cited to as far as believing that the appellant would not be inclined to be flexible. However, that all the other testimony did not reflect that there had been any problems in that regard, and she used one singular incident to find that factor in favor of the respondent. And I think that was kind of an arbitrary decision. It was based upon her preference and not based upon the actual facts and the history between the parties. The second factor that the court found that weighed in favor of the respondent or the appellant was the siblings. And I think that this is one of the crux of the issues in this case, is that the prior older sibling was already contemplated when the parties agreed that it was in her best interest, Luna's best interest, to reside in Nevada. And mom was pregnant at the time of trial, and the argument was raised that the new child needed to also maintain a relationship, and then that was kind of the main issue that they were pushing, was that there was a new child, and that was a change in circumstance. And I'll get to why I don't think that that is a change in circumstance sufficient to modify custody. But nevertheless, I think it raises an interesting issue and a bad policy decision to say that if a parent then subsequently goes and has more children, or solely for the purpose of finding a modification standard, that maybe there's everything else all equal, that if maybe I have a child, subsequent child, then that would give me a basis to modify custody, or that would be enough to skew the best interest analysis, which I think is not something that we would want to encourage necessarily. And then also when we're looking at the language of the statute where it says maintain a relationship, and are we maintaining a relationship with a child that, you know, was not present when we contemplated the original agreement? So I think that that poses an interesting question to the court, but the court was very persuaded by that being, and I think, the only substantial factor under the best interest analysis that went in favor of the respondent. And then also, there was, obviously, we already discussed the issue of domestic violence, which the court did not find rose any presumptions, and that there was no substantiated issues that would affect the best interest analysis. There was a abuse and neglect factor that was found slightly in favor of the respondent, once again, based upon something that had happened prior to the entry of the stipulated decree in 2016. Both parties testified that there had been both party and all other witnesses testified there had been no additional issues. It was known and played at the original trial, so this was not something that I think should have been used to push this factor in favor of the respondent for that reason. Because again, under Mosley that we are, in Nance and Castle, that we are bringing in things that shouldn't have been relitigated in this kind of a res judicata issue for that reason. And then to go into
the... Ms. Fleming, you're now at 4 minutes left. Do you want to save that time for rebuttal?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Okay. I hope I didn't cut you off, but I just want to make sure you were aware of it.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So 4 minutes for the plaintiff on rebuttal. The appellant, excuse me. And Mr. Grigsby, you are seated, and I can see you from about the neck up. Your name is superimposed on the screen, so that's partially blocking where you are. So it's not that you need to move. I'm just alerting you that that's better. Thank you. Can the judges in Las Vegas see him okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Grigsby, you have 15 minutes to respond for Crystal Slinkovich.
Yes, Aaron Grigsby here on behalf of the respondent, Crystal Slinkovich. The crux of this matter is really misinterpretation or misunderstanding of the plain language of the divorce decree by appellant. It's our position that the district court applied the correct legal standards when they used the Truax standard for custody and Potter for relocation. And a ruling on for appellant would ensure a result that actually contradicts the text and purpose of NRS 125C-0035 and the party's written stipulation that was incorporated into the decree of divorce. The decree of divorce has a specific language that the parties have agreed that the minor child, Laura, Luna, will be residing in Las Vegas by August 2nd, 2018, unless otherwise agreed upon by the parties or upon order of the court. And the language that appellant appears to be ignoring is the or upon order of the court. This clearly shows that the parties, when they made this agreement, contemplated that judicial intervention may be necessary at some point to resolve disputes between them. And so by ignoring that language, they're saying that as soon as respondent indicated that she was not coming back to Las Vegas, would not be back to Las Vegas by April 2nd, 2018, primary custody automatically shifted to appellant. And that is contrary to the plain language of their containing the decree of divorce. Now, it was actually appellants who actually filed the first motion to modify, followed soon thereafter by my client. Respondent filed a motion to modify and relocate. Given the fact that the time that the motions were filed was prior to the April 2nd, 2018 date, they both still had joint custody, joint physical custody and joint legal custody. At that point, and the evidentiary hearing occurred prior to the August 2nd, 2018 date. So at the time of the evidentiary hearing, the parties still maintained joint legal and physical custody, and therefore Truax was the correct standard to use to determine custody, and Potter was the correct standard to use for relocation. So to do what respondent wants you to do, respondent would like this, wants this court to essentially get engaged into what would be reformation of the contract by ignoring a crucial element. And this is exactly what Rivero says this court should not do, that we should interpret the agreement as written unless they are ambiguous. And at no point has appellant argued in their brief or even today that the decree of divorce and the provisions contained therein are ambiguous in any way. So the district court would have never had to get to the point of interpreting what they meant by a specific term in the decree of divorce, because at no time did they ever raise the argument that it was ambiguous or capable of more than one reasonable interpretation. And under that standard, when construing the document from its face, it's clear that the intervention by the district court was clearly contemplated, and the agreement should be enforced as written. Now, the next thing that respondent brings up is that, I'm sorry, appellant argues is that as soon as a motion was filed that said that respondent was contemplating not coming back to Nevada, that in and of itself was a triggering event that triggered a custody shift. That entire contention, once again, is contrary to the plain language of the decree of divorce and the terms for judicial intervention. And so there would never be that transfer never happened, the transfer of custody. Now, They also raised the issue of the district court reviewing the domestic violence claim. Now, although the district court found that that domestic violence wasn't proven by clear and convincing evidence, and therefore had no weight, they were allowed to do it. Even under Castle versus Simmons, the record is unclear as to whether the district court ever at any time reviewed domestic violence. And it would have been appellant's obligation to point out somewhere that the district court had heard this evidence of domestic violence during the prior trial that was eventually resolved. Absent that, I don't think that the appellate court under the standard of review, which is clearly erroneous, we have to take the fact that the district court allowed the domestic violence evidence to come in as that they never heard the evidence prior to the 2018 evidentiary hearing. I believe the last point was that they disagreed with the district court's application of the best interest standard. Now, the main issue they raised is that there was an incident where appellant would not allow respondent access to the child during the evidentiary hearing, when she was in Nevada during the evidentiary hearing. And the district court decided that was evidence that...
Mr. Grigsby?
Yes.
Before you move on to best interest, back to the domestic violence question, I'm sure you heard my question to Ms. Fleming about that. Are you suggesting that the district court did not know anything about allegations of domestic violence or abuse of the child at the time of the original divorce trial, and that this was new information, or that the district court did know about it?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that it was appellant's obligation to state one way or the other in their opening brief that the district court knew about it. They have to lay out the case that the district court was clearly erroneous by allowing this information in, or that they violated some rule or statute. They weren't allowed to hear this information. All they do is they say that the district court shouldn't have heard the information, but they don't lay out that the information had come before the court at some prior time. And without that piece of information, I believe that it's our position that the appellant fails in their argument that the district court improperly considered the information. Now, I think that the ultimate effect of it, since the district court said that they didn't meet the standard one way or the other, that it has no practical effect because it wasn't considered by the district court in its ultimate custody decision determination, because they didn't meet the clear and convincing standard. But appellant hasn't shown that the evidence should have been excluded, and that was their obligation to point out some part of the record that shows that the district court had, that this issue had been raised in the district court on a prior occasion, or that the district court had knowledge of this domestic violence, whatever it was, for it to be excluded. So it's our position they failed to meet their obligation in that respect. So I submitted that this court should not consider, it has to find the district court properly heard that evidence, because the appellant hasn't shown anything that would have precluded the district court from hearing the evidence.
Thank you.
Moving on back to the best interest standards, it's up to the district court to decide how much weight that they wanted to give to appellant denying access or not sharing access with the child during the time period before the evidentiary hearing in 2018. The district court states in their findings, which are fairly detailed, that most of the factors under 125C0035 didn't weigh heavily for one party or the other. But what they did find was that the sibling visitation factor weighed for on the side of respondent. Now, The position that appellant is taking is that the statute precludes you, in its sibling visitation portion, precludes the consideration of children who were not born at the time of the that the custody order came, that the decree of divorce was decided. And I would submit that that position is not supported by law. Our statute states sibling visitation and does not without limitations to whether they're full-born, full siblings, half-siblings, step-siblings. And there's nothing in the, as a poem, there's nothing in the legislative history to show that the legislature intended to limit this, the term siblings, in any way. Additionally, the term siblings, sibling visitation provisions appear in other areas of Nevada law, for example, 432D, and they also don't contain limits on whether the siblings, whether it's contemplated to be a full sibling, a half sibling, or a step sibling. It's the relationship in and of itself that the district court is allowed to consider as part of the best interest factors, and then decide how much weight it wants to give to the sibling visitation provisions. And the district court clearly found that the best interest factors weigh in favor of my client, Crystal Swansevich, having primary physical custody, and also weighed in favor of relocation to Virginia. I believe the last area that the opening brief really took issue with was the district court in their relocation determination, that they determined that the schools in Virginia would be, made an independent determination that the schools in Virginia would be better than the schools in Nevada. The district court's order clearly states that neither party provided much evidence on the schools one way or the other. But I would submit, although the decree doesn't state it outright, that the district court was allowed to take judicial notice of the fact that at the time, I believe for 4 years running at the time, Nevada schools had ranked 50th out of 50 states. So that would allow the district court to at least infer that Virginia schools were better than Nevada schools, and to whatever degree, and give that the appropriate amount of weight. But at no point have they shown that the amount of weight the district court was clearly erroneous in either making that determination that the schools in Virginia were better than schools in Nevada, or that they gave it an appropriate amount of weight. And it's our position that our case law states that that the appellate court should defer to the district court's factual and weight determinations, unless, once again, which would be an appellant's obligation to show that there wasn't substantial evidence to support those determinations, and it's our position that they failed to, in their obligation, their burden to show that the substantial evidence didn't support the district court's determinations to whatever degree. So it's our position, and we request that this court affirm the orders of the district court. At that point, if there's no further questions, I'll pass the balance of my time.
Mr. Grigsby, I have a question for you. The district court did not appear to apply the factors under 125C.0072. The threshold requirements were complied with or considered, and then the court went on to apply the best interest factors. Is there a concern there that the factors under Section 2 were not applied?
I would say no. The district court, it's just given the fact that it was a strict best interest determination, and from the fact that these parties had joint custody, I think the district court was correct in moving into applying the factors under 125C.0035.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, Mr. Grigsby, thank you very much. Ms. Fleming, you have 4 minutes in rebuttal for Mr. Slinkovich.
All right, thank you. I think I'm going to start with the last topic we were just addressing, that I do not believe the district court's findings on the relocation factors were supported by substantial evidence, specifically speaking to the actual benefit for the child in relocating with mother. I think that there was no dispute as to whether she had a good faith reason, whether it had, the move actually benefited her, but as far as the child, there wasn't the evidence. I do not think the findings were not supported by substantial evidence, specifically that they found that there was a financial benefit to the child residing with mother who made only $493 a month in income and was solely supported by grandparents. There was no of the financial ability of the appellant. And also, I would again bring up the school issue. The court made a comment that I had its feelers out there, but there was no evidence and really no discussion ever or testimony provided regarding whether the schools were better or in the area in which mom resided. I don't think that the court can take judicial notice when she doesn't know about probably a small town where they're residing. I don't think that that should have been a fact, needed to be supported by substantial evidence to be considered. And that I think that was a clearly erroneous factual finding on part on the part of the district court. To go back to some of the other things, I do believe that the term was ambiguous. I think that there was considerable argument at the beginning of the trial day regarding what factor was appropriate. Appellant did move for a directed verdict in the middle of trial based upon some of the very issues we're talking about, whether the court was going to make a decision based upon joint custody or primary custody. I think that it was an ambiguous term, so that there was some intent that needed to be considered by the district court. And as far as the terms in the decree of divorce, I do not think that there was any judicial intervention needed to make a determination. There was very clear, if she came back, they would have primary custody week on, week off. If she did not, that it would be in the best interest of the child to have primary. My client did file a motion proper person, but I do believe that was more to confirm that he had primary at that time based upon his knowledge of her not returning, not that he felt it was necessary to modify custody if we were to read what he was actually requesting in the motion. And as far as the domestic violence evidence, there was significant testimony at the time of the 2008 evidentiary hearing, 18 evidentiary hearing, about the three alleged incidents that the respondent brought up. The court could not probably have had a lot of knowledge about it prior to meeting the 2016 hearing. There was only one partial day of testimony heard prior to them deciding to stipulate to resolve the matter. But as far as that's concerned, the video in question regarding the minor child that the court discussed as far as the abuse neglect provision was played in 2016, but the bottom line is the court didn't make a decision in 2016 based upon the testimony and evidence. The parties made a decision that they felt was in the best interest of the child, knowing everything that they both knew. I mean, the parties knew the issues, and I can't imagine that a mother or a father would make a decision such as letting the child reside with dad if she had significant fears and concerns about abuse and neglect or domestic violence. So I think that those, we have to take parents at their word that they're able to make the best decisions, and despite the fact the court may not have had full knowledge of the domestic violence from 2016. And then briefly, the issue with the denying of access. It was the night before trial that the appellant said that he would not exchange the child. However, he did allow her to have time following the evidentiary hearing. That was a very minor issue that I think took up significant significance and was given undue weight given the history of the parties in the last 2 years, given there had been no issues with that. And that will conclude my argument on that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Fleming. And also thank you, Mr. Grigsby, again. The court will take this matter under submission and will enter a written order in the near future. We appreciate everyone appearing here today and the arguments that clarified some of the issues in front of us. This case has several. And we always know what a difficult situation it is when you're when we're talking about custody, that when there's a relocation involved, particularly to a jurisdiction far away, how tough that is on families and on the parties, particularly the parent that's left behind. I know when I was in district court and dealt with these cases, probably of all the cases I ever heard in district court, the relocation ones were the toughest. I hated them, to put it bluntly, but we follow the law. So, and in the appellate court, of course, we look at the record. And so most of the things you've said today, we've already read about, but there were a few things that were clarified, as I mentioned. So, again, we appreciate the argument and also Mr. Slinkovich coming in and attending it. I don't know if Ms. Slinkovich is watching from Virginia, because people can watch remotely, but there is a recording of the proceedings, so there's at least an audio recording available. I don't know if we have a video recording using this new system. Yeah, but I think we do, so it is available if somebody wants to see it. All right, Judge Tower, Judge Bullard, do you have anything further?
No, thank you both very much. We really appreciate you participating via the video conference. We know it has presented some challenges, but you both handled it very well, and we really appreciate you being willing to try this today.
Yeah, thank you very much. We appreciate your flexibility, and we know that this is, you know, very unusual, but everybody worked together, and I think the argument went very well. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both, then, and we'll be in recess.